He's a criminal prosecutor and Mormon historian. She's podcaster and executive director of Sunstone. Join Lindsay Hansen Park and John Dinger for Mormon History, Crime, and Punishment Stories. This is Season 1.
I really have discovered something at last. Through watching so much at night, when it changes so, I have finally found out. The front pattern does move. And no wonder, the woman behind shakes it. Sometimes, I think there are a great many women behind, and sometimes only one, and she crawls around fast, and her crawling shakes it all over. Then, in the very bright spots, she keeps still, and in the very shady spots, she just takes hold of the bars and shakes them hard. And she is all the time trying to climb through. But nobody could climb through that pattern. It strangles so. I think that is why it has so many heads. They get through, and then the pattern strangles them off and turns them upside down and makes their eyes white. If those heads were covered or taken off, it would not be half so bad. I think that woman gets out in the daytime, and I'll tell you why, privately. I've seen her. I can see her out of every one of my windows. It is the same woman, I know, for she is always creeping. The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman.
If you lived in the Victorian era, at any given time you had access to arsenic, strychnine, and cyanide. Not only were those compounds incredibly easy to access, you could find them in wallpaper, flypaper, paint, cosmetics, and more. People would die often and mysteriously, and the compounds would largely be untraceable or linked to food poisoning. Because they were so hard to trace, they were harder to link to foul play. Arsenic in particular became such a commonly used way to punish enemies that an act had to be passed in 1851 in the UK. The act called for arsenic to be mixed with indigo or soot to make it harder to disguise in pigment and in agricultural products such as sheep dressing or in someone's food. More and more drugs like strychnine and cyanide were used.
No, so this is the thing. I was researching murders on the frontier the other day, and strychnine became a keyword search. Don't ask. I do weird things sometimes. Doesn't matter. Anyway, there ended up being so many hits on that word, strychnine. And so I get curious. I'm like, gosh, what were people doing with strychnine all the time? I'd heard of it kind of, but I hadn't ever paid attention. Often it was just people poisoning the neighbor's dog. It was like something people did to retaliate. There was a lot of dog poisoning, super weird, but it was so incredibly common. And strychnine was not a good way to go. It was an awful way to go. It would cause its victims to froth and seize, and it was incredibly painful. So I'm surprised it was used so much.
Well, and this is in part why those drugs decreased over time or were harder to get and less available, because they began to be more publicly reported, really just in an effort to curb their use.
Okay, so that quote at the beginning of the episode is from an old short story written by Charlotte Perkins Gilman and first published in January 1892 in the New England Magazine. It's creepy and it's wild, and it's actually one of the first writings to sort of tackle the way women's mental health was written about. Basically, the plot is about a woman who spends the summer in an old colonial home with her husband, John. And in it, there's a room in the house where the bed is nailed to the floor and it has this old yellow wallpaper on the wall. And when you touch it, it sort of like dusts off on you, like leaves a trace. Anyway, the longer this woman spends in this room, the more the wallpaper changes shapes and moves and begins to dance. And she becomes really obsessed with it. And the wallpaper is heavily coated in arsenic and it begins to poison her. And of course, at the time, she doesn't know that the wallpaper is poison because they don't understand it. And of course, the male doctors and her husband, John, do their best, but they only attribute this to her madness. They have no idea she's being poisoned. Here's a quote from it. She says, "John says I mustn't lose my strength, and he has me take cod liver oil and lots of tonics and things, to say nothing of ale and wine and rare meat. Dear John, he loves me very dearly and hates to have me sick. I tried to have a real earnest, reasonable talk with him the other day and tell him how I wish he would let me go and make a visit to Cousin Henry and Julia. But he says I wasn't able to go nor able to stand it after I got there, and I did not make out a very good case for myself, for I was crying before I had finished. It's getting to be a great effort for me to think straight. Just this nervous weakness, I suppose. And dear John gathered me up in his arms and just carried me upstairs and laid me on the bed, sat by me and read to me till it tired my head. He said I was his darling and his comfort and all he had, and that I must take care of myself for my sake and keep well. The fact is, I'm getting a little afraid of John. Charlotte Perkins Gilman, The Yellow Wallpaper.
So many old compounds are dangerous. People died all the time from accidental poisonings, and people also died all the time from extra legal ones.
Okay, explain that to me. What is an extra legal poisoning?
Well, it's basically just anytime someone uses poisoning as a way to take up the law into their own hands, or rather to enact some sort of justice without using the legal system available at the time.
Okay, but isn't that basically all murders? I mean, couldn't that be said for any intentional poisonings? Like, the personal is political. And as author Morton Satin says in his book, Death in the Pot, the impact of food poisoning on history, quote, empires may have been lost over a few unsuspected molecules.
Right. I mean, I get what you're saying, but you have Socrates, and he was forced to take poison by rule of Athenian law, and he drank hemlock. Not a fun way to go. It looks peaceful from the outside, but the victims only look peaceful because their body is paralyzed by the drugs. They are slowly suffocating while their minds are awake.
Or Rasputin, that guy, right? The Russian guy who was one hard mofo to kill. Not even poison alone could do it. They had to club and shoot the guy to death. But, I mean, there's a lot of lore around his death, but his official cause of death was hypothermia. Oh, and Hamlet. Remember, they drop the poison in the ear, right? The entire play is laced with poison, if you will.
It was commonly thought to be hemlock, but the Hebanon poison Shakespeare describes in his play about political thirst, lust for power, and murder of your closest family and associates has really been under debate for a long time. No one's quite sure what its origins were, but yeah, poison is used a lot in that play.
Yes, and the entire thing is a motif for death of body and soul, of their morals. Poison is political. This is what I've been saying. It's been used as a tool for years to get rid of one's enemy. But motives and strategy regarding its usage is often complex.
But it's also been seen as a coward's weapon. Game of Thrones, for those of you who, you know, aren't good Mormons and watch it, call it a woman's weapon. But it was seen as sneaky and behind your back.
Don't you love that? They, like, women's things are seen as cowardly, but yet women are using these things. And that's the point, right? It's cunning. Women are seen as dangerous and cunning in a lot of historical literature. Plus, poison is tied to witchcraft and herb healings. And white women were using arsenic in the Victorian era to get a whiter complexion.
No, no. Teddy's got to go to Happy Dale now, at once. Now, he's down in the cellar. Get him up here right away.
Well, there's no such hurry as that.
No. When Ted is working on the canal, you can't get his mind on anything else.
Well, look, darlings. Look, I'm frightfully sorry, but I've got an awful shock for you. Ted has killed a man, darlings.
Nonsense.
But there's a body in the window seat.
Yes, dear. We know.
You know?
Of course. Yes, but it has nothing to do with Teddy.
But the thing...
Mortimer, you just forget about it. Forget you ever saw the gentleman.
Forget?
We never dreamed you'd peek.
What the... Who is he?
He's Mr. Hoskins. Adam Hoskins. That's really all I know about him, except that he's a Methodist.
Oh, he's a Methodist. Oh, isn't that nice?
That's all you know... Well, what's he doing here? What happened to him?
He died.
Yeah. Look, Aunt Martha, men just don't get into window seats and die.
Oh, no, dear. He died first.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Stop all this. Now, look, darling, how did he die?
Oh, Mortimer, don't be so inquisitive. The gentleman died because he drank some wine with poison in it.
Well, how did the poison get in the wine?
Well, we put it in wine because it's less noticeable. When it's in tea, it has a distinct odor.
You mean you put it in the wine?
Yes, and I put Mr. Hoskins in the window seat because Reverend Harper was coming.
Oh. Oh, look at me, darling. You mean you knew what you'd done and you didn't want the Reverend Harper to see the body?
Well, not at tea. That wouldn't have been very nice.
Oh, it's first degree.
Now, Mortimer, you know all about it and just forget about it. Mm-hmm. I do think that Martha and I have the right to our own little secrets.
I love this. This is a clip from Arsenic and Old Lace, which is a 1944 film with Cary Grant by Frank Capra. And if you haven't watched it, you should watch it. It's about the Brewster sisters in the Victorian era that love to poison people. They're homicidal maniacs, I guess. And this is sort of how they frame women as poisoners in this era. I mean, as far back as ancient Sumeria, we have over 3,000 spells and incantations written to get rid of your enemies. And they even had a goddess of poison. I think her name, if I'm pronouncing this right, was Gula. She was associated with healing. She was first associated with dogs because people noticed that when dogs licked their own wounds, they began to heal faster. And this goddess would be worshipped with the healers who used magic, and the healers used science, or rather modern practices at the time. They have this ancient Mesopotamian tablet in the British Museum in London dating back to 600 to 400 BCE that is chiseled away, telling you that if you wear a dried edible mouse that has been cured and stuffed with myrrh, you can prevent miscarriage. So there's stuff like that. But Gula also was known to punish your enemies and the wicked with potions and poisons. And so maybe this first gets women associated with poison. At least this is one of the earliest written references that I know of.
Well, let's not be sexist. I mean, everybody was using it. Consider the classics. Greeks and Romans used hemlock and aconite. And in ancient Rome, it became so common that a public health campaign began to be started with the phrase, and I'm gonna slaughter this, Lindsay, so get ready, but armus bella non venisi geri, which means war should be fought with weapons instead of poison.
I think you did pretty good. Well, it might have helped deter people in Rome at the time, but poison is really, like you said, as old as history itself. I mean, you mentioned the Greeks and Romans. I'm partial to medieval poisons like belladonna and mandrake, but my favorite are still the Victorian three: strychnine, arsenic, and cyanide, which, as you said, was everywhere. All you need is access to dangerous compounds and maybe a motive. And it's not just Socrates in the ancient world. I had a hard time narrowing down the poison stories because there were too many. So take this story out of Chicago, Illinois. In 2012, Arooj Khan stopped by the convenience store to pick up a lottery ticket. He won what most people only dream of, the $1 million jackpot from the Illinois lottery. The day the check was issued for the lump sum cash out of $425,000, Khan would be rushed to the hospital and pronounced dead. He had received the news about his win, went home and ate dinner with his family, and woke up in the night screaming. At first, the death was ruled natural causes and no autopsy was performed, until a concerned family member came forward and asked for further investigation. Khan's blood was tested, and it was revealed that lethal amounts of cyanide were found in his body.
New developments in the mysterious murder of a Chicago man who won a $1 million lottery jackpot. NBC's Kevin Tibbles reports.
Arooj Khan was feeling very lucky after he won $1 million in the Illinois lottery last June.
I donated a lot of churches and everything.
Not even a month after posing with a giant check, Khan, who was 46 years old, died. At the time, the medical examiner ruled he died of natural causes.
Very healthy, a very hardworking person.
But relatives raised suspicions, and authorities discovered he was poisoned with cyanide.
He went from work straight home. It is last dinner.
No suspects have been named. Khan's siblings are in a legal battle with his widow, Shabana Ansari, over his lottery winnings. In probate court documents, Khan's brother says he wants to ensure Khan's daughter from a prior marriage receives her proper share. NBC News talked to Khan's widow at his dry cleaning business. She would not go on camera, but said she still can't believe someone would want to harm him. He was such a nice person. No one would dare do that. Authorities now want to exhume Khan's body. Kevin Tibbles, NBC News, Chicago.
Okay, so this is an interesting story and all, but it seems more like a crime of passion and not extra legal. What I mean is, let's say a wife did poison him for his money. That seems pretty straightforward. She killed him for the money, but she wasn't trying to get justice.
Okay, this is what I need you to explain to me, though. If we're going to be doing a series of extra legal stuff, what's the difference? Because the personal is political, right? She kills for money, others kill for power. It's the same thing, someone getting someone else out of the way so they can have the thing.
Sure, but I want to dig more specifically into obvious cases of extralegal poisoning.
Okay, well, I chose the story in Illinois for a reason, because I want to stay in Illinois for a second. But let's back up a century and a half to Nauvoo.
You want to talk about poisonings in Nauvoo?
It's so funny you should ask that. Okay, I'm excited to have with me someone who I really love and admire, Johnny Stevenson. Can you say hello?
Hi.
All right, Johnny, tell us who you are. Tell us a little bit about you before we get into this.
I am a retired independent historian about all things Mormon. I've been published in the John Whitmer Historical Journal, and I'm working on a book called Spiritual Wives about Joseph Smith's polygamy in Nauvoo. And before that time, how it developed. So that's a little bit about me.
That's amazing. Well, thanks for coming on today to talk about poison. I'm hoping we can sort of talk about what we know, and then I want your opinion because you've been doing a lot of research. Before we get into the stories, do you want to tell us sort of what's out there and what you've been looking into?
We do have some evidence. But sometimes it's very hard when you're looking at things from many years later to figure everything out. And with this topic, I don't think that's any different. What I found interesting in the case of poisonings in Nauvoo is that other religions that I've studied, you know, for example, like Seventh-day Adventism came about in America. I have never run across this kind of a situation where people are being accused of poisoning others, and there's so many incidents of violence towards leaders and, you know, with power struggles and things of that nature. It's kind of like unique to Nauvoo and this period of time.
Okay, yeah, so let's talk about it. We are talking about poisoning. We're talking about poisonings today. What do we know? What do we have on Nauvoo poisonings, and why poison?
I've thought about that a lot, and I think it's basically to keep things secret. You know, you have the Mormon teaching of blood atonement, but that was basically a sentence carried out in a theocracy where someone was punished for doing crimes. And it was in a public way. Poisoning is kind of insidious in a way that it's getting enemies out of the way, but in order to keep it a secret. So, you know, them being able to justify that goes to the heart of what we really want to talk about here today, I think, is motivation and why it was so important for them to put some people out of the way. Why Joseph or others would feel so threatened that they would resort to this type of a solution.
So when we're talking about poisonings, are we talking about non-Mormons poisoning Mormons or Mormons poisoning non-Mormons? Who is using the poison?
That's a really good question. There were accusations made by Mormons against Mormons. And there were accusations made by non-Mormons against the Mormons. For example, I found a newspaper article from the Daily Missouri Republican dated from September of 1841 about a store owner named Kilborn. And he had some kind of a problem with the Nauvoo militia. And here's what the article states. We learned from the Hawkeye that two horses of Messenger's Kilborn were poisoned. The act is attributed to the Mormons because it occurred while Kilborn was under examination on a charge of conspiracy against the Mormons. Great excitement was prevailing and serious consequences were apprehended. So I dug a little deeper and I found this diary entry from the Journal of Joseph Swayze. From the 13th of September, 1841, he writes, Joseph Smith received an invitation from Brigadier General Ezekiel Swayze, related, I guess, to the diary, to the person writing the diary, and Colonel Fuller of the militia of Lee County, Iowa, to a military parade the next day in Montrose as a visitor. General Hiram Smith and John C. Bennett received similar invitations. Then the next day, on the 14th of September, 1841, he writes, "Joseph Smith went over to Montrose, accompanied by brothers Hunter and Green. I was very courteously received by General Swasey, the officers and militia. D.W. Kilbourn attempted to get up an ill feeling by reading the following proclamation at noon during the recess of exercise to a considerable number of persons collected around his store, which I insert verbatim. Citizens of Iowa, the laws of Iowa do not require you to muster oath or be reviewed by Joe Smith or General Bennett, and should they have the impudence to attempt it, it is hoped that every person having a proper respect for himself will at once leave the ranks. This, however, had no effect whatsoever on the people. Myself and brother were not in military uniform, but were treated with every respect that visiting officers of our rank could be. Through the entire day, at the dismissal of the military, I went to Mr. Kilbourn's store and desired to have some conversation with him, but he was peremptorily ordered out of doors. This conduct greatly disgusted his few friends, who upbraided Kilbourn with his ungentlemanly conduct, and accompanied me to the ferry, where I left them, showing me every manifestation of friendship." So, you know, Swasey says that this was that there was some kind of an altercation between Kilbourn and the Mormons due to the Nauvoo militia. He was a store owner that didn't like the Mormons, you know, mustering and doing those kinds of things. And so newspaper article reported that his horses were poisoned and that it was blamed on the Mormons. So we have this incident of the Mormons being accused of poisoning animals. And there were accusations later that not only animals, but people were poisoned among the Mormons. And I guess we'll get into that.
Now, do you know what kind of poisons they use? Because I've been looking into poisonings in the Victorian era in general, and there are a lot of instances of people poisoning their neighbors' animals or dogs with strychnine as a sort of a way to, you know, if the dog is being annoying or there's a dispute over land, it's sort of the easiest way to get revenge. You poison someone's animals.
I don't know much about the poison itself. All I can recall is that there were some accounts that mentioned a white powder. For example, that Samuel H. Smith was given a white powder by, I believe it was Hosea Stout, and that Willard Richards, being a doctor, was involved in it. And they had given this white powder to Samuel H. Smith to put him out of the way because he was being, designated by Joseph to be his successor, and they wanted Brigham Young to lead the church. And so these accusations were made by the Smith family, and that there was another person that was also being doctored at the same time, and he didn't trust the cure given to him and Samuel Smith, and he threw down, stopped taking the white powder, and he survived, and Samuel H. Smith took all of it, and it killed him. So I'm not really familiar with anything more than those types of accounts.
Okay, well, let's get into some of the human poisonings. What are some of the most prominent accounts that you've been able to find? And then let's talk about the credibility of the accounts.
I found some really surprising evidence about poisonings in Nauvoo. One that took me by surprise was an accusation that was made against Joseph Smith that he poisoned his clerk, his scribe, James Mulholland.
How many scribes did Joseph have? My goodness.
Yes, Joseph had a lot of scribes. But as to what I found about James Mulholland, in 1892, W.A. Hatton published a pamphlet titled "Origin of the Book of Mormon, the character of its authors examined and weighed in the balance and found wanting, the revelation on polygamy and the doctrines of the Latter-day Saints in conflict with the Bible." And this person had a debate with a Brother Scott from the RLDS Church. Now, Hatton, in this debate, accused Joseph Smith of poisoning James Mulholland, his secretary at the time. Now, what's interesting about this is that these kind of anti-Mormon debates took place a lot in the late 1800s. And, you know, some sensational claims were made on both sides, you know, persecution, or that the Mormons were doing this, that, or the other. So, you know, Joseph poisoning someone wasn't a novel idea at that time. And so it struck me as very odd, almost, that the RLDS Church would contact the relatives of Mulholland and have them refute it. Now, these relatives were on the wife's side. He was married to a woman named Sarah Scott, and they were related to the Warnock family. And so on September 26, 1892, an affidavit was made by William Warnock, Mary Warnock, and Susan Warnock, and Eliza Newberry, and J.S. Roth. Those were the ones that were involved with it and witnessed. And it said, to whom it may concern, we the undersigned do hereby testify and make oath to the same when called upon to do so. We were personally acquainted with Mr. James Mulholland. He was our brother-in-law. He was Joseph's scribe. When the saints were leaving far west, he had to sleep in the cold, wet ground in April, from which he took a severe cold, which developed into brain fever, and from which he died in a few months from the time he took cold. We never heard from friend or foe till now that he was poisoned. We also know that Dr. Samson Avard organized the Danite band. He wanted Joseph to let him act as the destroying angel, and he would poison the wells. But Joseph positively refused to do so and denounced him for his wickedness. So that's the affidavit we have, and we find another instance of poison in that affidavit, that Avard, under Joseph's supervision, was commanded to poison the wells of the Missourians, which I found interesting.
So tell us about Samson Avard for a minute, because people who know Mormon history know that name, but some people may have never heard of him before.
Well, he was a member of the church, and he was one of Joseph's associates during the Missouri period, and he was put in charge of the Danites, which were an organization that Joseph Smith, in 1844, Joseph Smith claimed that he named the Danites, number one. Number two, but he denied that they existed, which was not true. And Joseph has an entry in his diary about the Danites that that affirms that they were an organization that Joseph was behind. So Avard basically was the fall guy for everything that happened in Missouri. He was blamed for everything that Joseph was involved with, and that's who he was.
And so he's accused of poisoning wells and things like that. That was one way to get poison to people. Do we have more stories of individual poisonings that would have been, I mean, is this something that we believe Joseph Smith would have ordered Samson to do, or would Samson have acted on his own?
Hard to say. What's interesting, I believe that Joseph had something to do. There was a lot of rhetoric involved with Joseph, violent rhetoric. And that's the question that we have to ask ourselves. And that's really the purpose behind this. There were, I call them, a friend of mine calls them mysterious deaths in Nauvoo. There were some what's called mysterious deaths in Nauvoo. And the reason that we call them that is because there's this entry by William Clayton in his diary. And I'll get it. This goes to motive for Joseph. So why would he want to poison people? Okay. I'll go into who they were in a minute. But on May 29th, 1843, Joseph asked William Clayton a question. He said, he asked him if he had used any familiarity with Emma, which is a strange question to ask William Clayton. But this is, but Joseph had some problems, I believe, with jealousy and those kinds of things. Then a month later, Clayton writes this in his diary, and it's important enough, I think, to read. He writes, "This A.M., President Joseph took me and conversed considerably concerning some delicate matters, said Emma wanted to lay a snare for me. He told me last night of this and said that he felt troubled. He said Emma had treated him coldly and badly since I came, and he knew she was disposed to be revenged on him for some things. She thought that if he would indulge himself, she could too. She would too. He cautioned me very kindly, for which I felt thankful. He said Robert Thompson,
profess great friendship for him, but he gave way to temptation and he had to die. And Brother Vincent Knight, he gave him one, but he went to loose conduct and he could not save him. Vincent Knight also died. Also, Brigham Young had transgressed his covenant and he pled with the Lord to spare him this end, death, and he did so. Otherwise, he would have died. Brigham denied having transgressed. He said, if I would do right by him and abide his counsel, he would save my life while he lived. I feel desirous to do right and would rather die than lose my interest in the celestial kingdom. So what is this about Robert Thompson and Vincent Knight where they had to die? That's a kind of a strange way to put things, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so we're looking at, a few things, and it seems that it's all involved with polygamy, or, you know, Joseph's spiritual wife system, that these are people that were close to him and involved with that.
Do we know of anyone who did die, who they assumed it was poisoning, or were they just attempts?
Well, we have Samuel H. Smith that they believe died from poison.
But it was certainly a threat that was prevalent enough that several people thought that they were at risk for it. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. The interesting thing is that I wanted to talk about Thompson and Vincent Knight because there seems to be motive for Joseph to want them out of the way. That's what I wanted to look at, and what I wanted to what I was trying to explain earlier was that okay, we have people. We have Joseph making the comment that, you know, well, Vincent Knight had to die. Robert Thompson had to die. Brigham Young, he would have died, but he repented. So, you know, did they just happen to die? Did the Lord take them, or were they helped along? You know, and so if they were helped along, what's the motive? What would Joseph have a motive of? Why would he do that? What would be the motive for that? And is there any evidence that he had a motive, or that he made comments to get rid of these people? Okay, yes. Was Thompson a threat to Joseph Smith? Now, he was a wonderful guy. Everybody says that he was an outstanding person. He never did anything wrong. And so it makes you wonder why Joseph would say this to Robert Thompson. And we get this from Oliver B. Huntington. He says, Robert, I want you to go on a bust. Go and get drunk and have a good spree. If you don't, you will die. Huntington also writes in his journal that Robert Thompson did not do it and that he was a very pious and exemplary man and never guilty of such an impropriety as he thought that to be. In less than 2 weeks, he was dead and buried. Now, I don't know why, Oliver Huntington thought that's so important to mention in his journal, but it's there.
That to me is just simply an amazing journal entry. Joseph wanted his scribe to go get drunk or he would die. That's very interesting. Or was there some ulterior motive to Joseph wanting him to go enjoy himself, maybe as some kind of a last party before he was put out of the way? Makes you wonder. But was Thompson a threat to Joseph? That's the question that was bothering me. And I found some evidence that maybe he was. And this is from a few years later in 1844, and this was at the Nauvoo City Council on June 10th of that year. The notes read, the mayor said, Joseph H. Jackson has been proved a murderer before this council, and the mayor declared the paper a nuisance, a greater nuisance, greater than a dead carcass. They make it a criminality for a man to have a wife on the earth while he has one in heaven. According to the keys of the Holy Priesthood, the mayor read the statement of William Law in the Expositor, where the truth of God was transformed into a lie. He read the statements of Austin Cowles and said he had never had any private conversation with Austin Cowles on these subjects, and that he preached on the stand from the Bible showing the order in ancient days having nothing to do with the present time. What the opposition party wanted was to raise a mob on us and take the spoil of us as they did in Missouri. He said that he had as much as he could do to keep his clerk Thompson from publishing the proceedings of the laws and causing the people to amass against them. So he would rather die tomorrow and have the thing smashed than live and have it grow.
So that's an amazing statement right there. So Joseph would rather have died than see what live and grow, have what smashed, the expositor? Did Smith think that his death would stop the laws? It apparently did. It is hard to know what Joseph meant because he told so many falsehoods at this time about various people. For example, it was not the laws that Thompson and Don Carlos Smith were publishing against. It was John C. Bennett and unknowingly Joseph Smith. Here's another quote. Both Don Carlos and Thompson had heard the rumors about polygamy going on within the leadership. They died in August of 1841, so this was early on and 3 years before things really became exposed to the point that Joseph and Hiram were killed. So Joseph was really still doing everything in almost complete secrecy and pretty much getting away with it at this point. And he was just beginning to let a few others in. Hiram didn't even know what was really going on, and neither did Emma for sure yet. Obviously, she knew that he cheated on her, but she didn't know about the lengths Joseph would go with the spiritual wifery, etc.
Well, we know that Joseph felt threatened even by Emma at one point, so he was questioning the loyalty of everyone around him.
Yes, he was questioning the loyalty of everyone around him, even his bishop, Vincent Knight, which was the other person, one of the other people that Clayton mentions in his journal entry. Joseph gave Knight one, but he went to loose conduct and he could not save him. Martha McBride Knight was equally involved in the key events of Nauvoo. She was a founding member of the LDS Relief Society, being present at the organizational meeting on the 17th of March, 1842, which was her 37th birthday. Martha was told by Joseph that she was the first woman to give her consent for her husband to enter into plural marriage. The story is told that Martha knew something was worrying her husband and couldn't seem to tell her about it. And then she was sitting in the grape arbor behind the house and Vincent returned home carrying a basket. He explained to Martha that he had taken some fruit and vegetables to the widow of Levi N. Merrick, whose husband had been killed at Hahn's Mill. Vincent explained to Martha that he had been told to enter plural marriage and that if he had to, this sister Merrick would be the one he could help best. Martha's reply is said to have been, "Is that all?" Perhaps she had confidence in her husband's choice, since Philander Clark Eldridge Merrick was also a founding member of the Relief Society. At a time when Martha and her husband were becoming even more greatly involved in the affairs of Nauvoo, her husband of 16 years suddenly took ill and died on the 31st of July, 1842, in Nauvoo at the relatively young age of 38. Joseph preached at his funeral, stating that Vincent was the best friend he ever had on earth. A month later, Martha lost her youngest child, less than 1 year old, Rudolphus Knight, who died on the 3rd of September, 1842. So she was just overcome with tragedy at the time. And then in order to make ends meet, she moved to the second floor of her house, which wasn't even finished yet, and rented out the downstairs to the George Grant family. And then sometime during the summer of 1842, and one source states that it was before the death of Vincent Knight, Martha was married to Joseph Smith Jr. by Heber C. Kimball. This is basically from the life story of Martha McBride Knight by Brent Belknap. Now, what I find fascinating about this is that Joseph, there's another mention made of an incident that took place with what I'm wondering about Vincent Knight is if the woman that he chose, Merrick, was one that Joseph wanted him to marry. Because Joseph sometimes had his eye on the same women. For example, there's an entry in Clayton's diary which reads, "Dined at Brother Babbitt's, President Joseph said to Brother Johnson that Joseph be noble when he was first taught this doctrine, polygamy, set his heart on one woman, and pressed Joseph to seal the contract, but he never could get opportunity. It seemed that the Lord was unwilling." The Lord or Joseph. "Finally, another came along, and he then engaged that one and is a happy man. I learned from this anecdote never to press the prophet, but wait with patience, and God will bring all things right. I feel to pray to God that he will let me live so that I may come to the full knowledge of truth and salvation and be prepared for the enjoyment of a fullness of the Third Heavens. This was on May 17th, 1843. What's interesting about the Noble entry here is that I believe that Joseph Noble wanted to marry his wife's sister, which was Louisa Beeman, and that Joseph wanted her for himself, and that Noble then chose another bride and was married to her afterward. Now, this will this changes a lot, and I believe that the Beeman marriage didn't take place in 1841, but it took place in 1842. And then we have this whole thing with Vincent Knight. He wanted to marry this one woman, and I believe maybe that Joseph didn't want him to, and he had his heart set on Vincent's wife, who he married a month or so after Vincent died, I believe, or right around the same time. And Joseph then also wanted to marry their daughter, Almira. She said no. And later on, she made the statement, "I, Almira K. Hanscom, know that spiritual marriage, as it was called, was taught by Joseph and Hiram Smith when in Nauvoo before they were killed, and that this spiritual marriage allowed men to have more than one wife at the same time. I also know that Emmeline and Harriet Page came to me and said that this was a hard trial, and they tried to convince me." So Joseph had women going to these other women to try to convince them. So what was Vincent Knight's loose conduct? I believe it wasn't necessarily something immoral, but that it was maybe loose lips. Loose lips sink ships, and that Joseph felt threatened by Thompson, who was going to publish things, felt threatened by Vincent Knight for some reason, or he had ulterior motives in wanting his wife and daughter, and maybe Knight didn't go for that. It's hard to say. There were other instances where Joseph wanted women and they said no, and he didn't resort to this these kinds of comments about them, that they had to die. So it's hard to say in some ways what this all means. We can only present the evidence and speculate about it, and that's what I'm doing.
Tell us a few other cases that you think are pretty compelling, and then let's talk about Emma Smith.
Sure. Yeah, I wanted to also, we're going into motive here. Did Joseph threaten people? Was it in his nature to do so? What is there to this poisoning? Is there any evidence that Joseph directed people to poison people? And yes, I have found some. One is from an account by Joseph H. Jackson, who was a confidant of Joseph Smith, who left a very interesting account. Joe boasted of his feats and schemes and how cunningly he had carried his measures. He spoke of his spiritual wives particularly and called them great captains in his service to carry out his design, and remarked that through them he could get any stranger's money. I asked him how he would work the matter, to which he replied that he had only to tell certain of his spiritual wives that such a man had been in the Missouri War, and that he should be put out of the way, and his property and money consecrated to the use of the church. Then, said he, it's damned easy for them to get into his good graces and to mix a white powder with his victuals and put him out of the way. I told him that he ought to give me the names of these women, as they might be of great service to me in carrying out his secret measures. Previous to Joe having settled upon any particular plan for the removal of Law, he sent for Hiram to counsel with him. We all three took a walk down to the river bank, and Joe made known to Hiram that he had told me the whole plot against Law's life, which appeared to please him. But he opposed Joe's plan of assassination and stated that if Law was cut off in this manner, it would bring the whole Gentile world down upon them. He then suggested that what he called a better plan of operation, which was to win Law's friendship by appearing sorry, that he would get his wife and apologizing for what had happened, and then invite him to a party where they could easily put a white powder in his tea. Joseph thought a few moments on the plan and said that Emma would be in the way, and she would not suffer it. Hiram met this objection by saying that he would get his wife to call off Emma's attention, and then Mrs. Thompson and Mrs. Durfee would do up the business. Law would be taken suddenly ill, and they would be called to lay hands on him, and no one would suspect the cause of his death. This course he deemed much safer than Joe's, because by his plan, there would be suspicion and trouble. Joe said that he would take the evening to think on it. Soon after, we arrived at the Nauvoo house, and Joe went home. Hiram and myself proceeded alone to Joe's store. When we arrived there, I proposed to walk back of the store to the river, being desirous to get something further out of Hiram. I then asked him some questions about Mrs. Thompson, whether she could be trusted, etc. I told him that I did not want her acquaintance unless she was one of the secret spiritual wives, and now I did not doubt it. Said he, "Who told you?" I replied that the prophet told me, not only of her, but of nearly all their secret women, and it was right that he did, for they might be of service to me in carrying out their measures. "Yes," said he, "I have slept between her and my wife." "My God," said I, "how did you keep them from quarreling?" "Oh," said he, "they are sisters, and that is not all. They are one in Christ Jesus." So Jackson gives us this account, and I was discussing this with my friend Christopher Smith, and he asked these questions. The use of the term captain described these wife assassins is interesting because the Danites had been organized into companies headed by captains, and the Nauvoo police were also headed by a captain. Both these organizations were primarily designed to intimidate and kill dissenters. Were Mrs. Thompson and Mrs. Durfee part of a female company or counterpart of the Danites? And that's really an interesting question. Now, this Jackson account is very interesting because if he was simply making things up, then how did he know that Hiram had married Robert Thompson's wife? How did he know the things that he did? And Jackson claims that this took place while Smith was living at the Nauvoo house, the Nauvoo mansion. And what is interesting is that Jackson had an altercation with Joseph back in May of 1843, where Joseph had gone out to visit his farm with Emma, and he came back and he found that Joseph had been speaking with one of his spiritual wives, Eliza Partridge, who was living in the house then, and Joseph got very upset at Jackson over the situation and Emma, because Joseph had gone up to the room and Emma had gotten curious and went up there, and Joseph had held the door on her and wouldn't let her in the room because he was speaking with Eliza Partridge, and this upset Emma to no end. And it was shortly after this that Emma found out that he had secretly married the Partridge sisters. And this just turned her further against Joseph and his spiritual wifeism. But this is all written about by William Clayton in his journal. My point is that Joseph had a volatile relationship with Jackson, and anyone that he thought was coming in between him and his spiritual wives, or Emma for that matter. And he basically called Jackson rotten-hearted to Clayton. But we have Jackson speaking of events that happened in the Nauvoo mansion when they moved out of the homestead. And so Jackson was still around. In fact, he was made an aide-de-camp of Joseph Smith on January 5th, 1844. And so this is a lieutenant colonel. So he, in the militia, Joseph was still confiding things in Jackson well into 1844.
Okay. Yeah. No, I think that that's really compelling, especially based on the things that you were saying. And I can't help but think that there are a lot of people that still deny that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. But this is a good example of where we get contemporary reports of people talking about it in real time. There's just, it was happening in Nauvoo. And because of that, because it was so secretive, I mean, that gives a lot of motive right there, right? It's bringing a lot of persecution on Mormons. It's getting Joseph Smith in a lot of trouble. And it's bringing up a lot of complicated feelings for everyone. So right there makes sense why that gives some motive to people, right? So Tom Kimball told me once, Johnny Stevenson claims that you are more likely to die of poison in the Nauvoo Legion than any other thing. And then when I asked you about it, you were kind of skeptical about the sources, but some of this sounds pretty compelling.
About the Nauvoo Legion?
Just the poisoning in general. I thought you were going to give me really speculative stuff, but it sounds like there's some really compelling evidence.
Yeah, we have I want to come back. I'm sorry. I'm mentioning William Law because I want to come back to a point that Joseph Jackson made. It's an important point. And this again goes to motive and what Joseph was doing and how can we justify that any of this is credible? Okay. That's what we have to really think of. You know, we have all of these people talking about poison. We have all of these things going on about doughheads and traitors and how they were treated. And, you know, they want to put them out of the way. And some people are claiming it's just rhetoric, you know, and there's, you know, might not be anything behind it. But really, was there something behind it? So what did Joseph Jackson say about Joseph, how he would explain to these women the means to get rid of somebody? He said this. He said, I asked him how he would work the matter, to which he replied that he had only to tell certain of his spiritual wives that such a man had been in the Missouri War and that he should be put out of the way and his property and money consecrated to the use of the church. He would bring up Missouri, okay, in relation to these people. They were against us. They're in league with the Missourians. And this is exactly what Joseph did with William Law, which I found really stunning. At a June meeting of the city council, Joseph Smith does in public what Jackson claimed he did in private with his captains. He implicates William Law in a Missourian plot to kill him. And here's Joseph at a city council meeting in June of 1844, just before he died. At the time, Governor Thomas Carlin was pursuing him with his writs. William Law came to my house with a band of Missourians for the purpose of betraying me, come to my gate, and was prevented by Daniel Carnes, who was set to watch. They had come within his gate, and Carn called the mayor, and after the mayor reproved Law for coming at that time of night, Daniel Carn was sworn and said that about 10 o'clock at night, a boat came up the river with a dozen men. William Law came to the gate with them when he was on guard, and he stopped them. Law called to Joseph to the door and wanted an interview. Joseph said, Brother Law, you know better than to come here at this hour of the night. And Law returned. The next morning, Law wrote a letter to apologize, which Carn had heard read, which was written apparently to screen himself, Law, from the censure of a conspiracy. And the letter betrayed a conspiracy on the face of it. So here we have Joseph in June of 1844 accusing William Law in 1842 of bringing a band of Missourians to his house to kidnap him. Now, this is so absurd that at the time, Joseph was in hiding, and William Law was one of the few people that knew where he was and went to see him. You know, he was on the other side of the Missouri River in Iowa, I believe, where he was hiding out from the Missourians. And he wrote in his diary, the Book of the Law of the Lord, all these gushing things about William and Wilson Law and how they were his best friends, that he would always be true to them, would always be their friend, that they couldn't do anything that would make Joseph not love them. I mean, this is all written in his journal in August of 1842 about William Law. But yet Joseph goes before a city council and tells him this wild story about William Law bringing Missourians to his house to kidnap him. Now, what does this tell you? Why would Joseph go to this length to try to slander William Law? Because he's setting it up. He wants to turn those people against him so they have a reason to do what? Maybe take him out.
Interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating.
The playbook that Joseph Jackson was talking about. So I wanted to bring that up. And then we have this other whole thing about poisoning that makes me scratch my head because, and this has to do with Emma. And of course, the story is that Joseph, at the end of 1843 in November, that Joseph was eating at the table and then he got sick and that he vomited and that he later on told others that he had been poisoned by Emma. Brigham Young told the story, and so did a few others. And the timing of it has always been interesting to me because it happened about 3 days, it happened on November 5th, 1843, that Joseph got sick. But 3 days earlier, Joseph had married his last plural wife, Fanny Young. And he had done so when he had told Emma that, number one, he told Emma in August that he would give up all his plural wives because she had put her foot down and said, nope, this is not happening. Emma was actively working against Joseph's polygamy. And then in September, he married Melissa Lott, which was one of his wives, secretly. And she was living in the mansion house at the time. And Melissa Lott testified that she never, ever saw Emma the whole time she was in the mansion house. Never saw her. Emma didn't know about Melissa Lott. And so then Joseph has Fanny Young sealed to him. And then 3 days later, he comes down with this case of vomiting and thinks he's poisoned. And I believe that Joseph connected the events in his mind. Oh, and in October, a month before, Joseph specifically went outside and up and down the street, and he brought his scribe with him to record his words that there shall be no more polygamy in the church, no more plural wives. I order it. And he did this in front of his house. And so I believe it was for Emma's benefit that he did this. So Emma was told by him, okay, I've quit. I've stopped. There's going to be no more plural wives. And then in November, he sealed to Fanny Young. And 3 days later, he gets violently ill, and he thinks that Emma poisoned him. Now, why would he think Emma poisoned him? That's a whole other question. But I don't think that she did, by the way. I don't think Emma would ever have dreamed of poisoning Joseph. This was all Joseph's paranoia. But
and I think it speaks to the fact that the fact that he even feared it means that it was in the water, right? Means that people were using this, or there was the threat of poison at least existed.
Well, if Joseph was manipulating women into doing this, as Joseph Jackson said, then he had every reason to believe that maybe Emma could do it too. That's my point. But the thing about the incident is that Joseph believes that Emma did this, I think, because he had married this woman. And so after that, this incident, Joseph does not have another plural wife, doesn't take another one. That was his last one. So something about it was very serious to him, this whole incident involving the poison, Fanny Young, and spiritual wives. He stopped doing it. And I think he was terrified that Emma was going to, you know, Emma said she would divorce him if he took any more. So she didn't do that. But that threat was out there. That was out there since August of 1843. Now, what's interesting here is that I want to answer the question as to why would Joseph think that Emma could do it. So Joseph was married to a woman called Desdemona Fulmer, and she was 30 years old. Of her years before 1840, this is from Todd Compton. Of her years before 1842, we know little. On July 29th, 1839, her brother John Solomon was baptized in Nauvoo at age 32. David Fulmer was a high counselor by May of 1842, so had stature equivalent to that of a present-day Mormon general authority. Desdemona would have gained visibility and joined the female hierarchy of Nauvoo as a result. This is corroborated by two data concerning her from 1842. In the spring, Desdemona Fulmer was living in the Joseph Smith household with Elvira Cowles and the Partridge sisters. So like many of Smith's wives, she lived under the same roof with him before the marriage and had the opportunity to become well acquainted with him. She was also present at the first meeting of the Female Reason Society of Nauvoo on March 17th, and on April 19th contributed $1.25 to the society. That's from Todd Compton. That's a great little summary of who she was. Now, according to Desdemona Fulmer, Joseph told her that he believed that Emma was totally capable of poisoning her, and so she needed to leave Joseph and Emma's household, homestead, where she had been living since at least mid-1842, according to the Nauvoo census. And so Desdemona went to live with Hiram Smith. This posed a dilemma for Fulmer, as she later recalled. After I left Brother Joseph's house, Sister Hiram wanted me to come for the winter and with her to work at tailoring as that trade. And while I was living at their house, Hiram had by some way learned something about polygamy. So one evening while the family of us was sitting around, he said to me, I will ask you a fair question. We answer it. And Brother Hiram, he said, supposing Brother Joseph would say to you that he had a revelation from God, that it was right for him to have another wife besides Emma, would you believe it was from God? She asked him if he believes J.S. is a prophet. Yes. And she says that he is a prophet. She can't pick and choose which revelation she will believe. And our conversation ended for that evening. Soon after morning, he made mention of the subject in the following words, said if he knew that any or thought that any woman in his house believed in such doctrine as polygamy, I would kick him 40 rods from his house and follow them and kick them still further. Soon after, I made tracks, not feeling it safe to stay there any longer, and went to another place to live, which was William Clayton's house. Now, while living there a few weeks afterwards, brothers Joseph and Hiram came along and called there, and Brother Hiram wanted to talk to me and said, do you remember how I talked when was at my home? Yes, sir, I do. said he, "Now I have come to make it right with you. I hurt your feelings. I ask your forgiveness. And where I said anything about against the doctrine of polygamy in public or private, I must take it all back, as the Lord has shown me that I was wrong and that Joseph was right. Hiram preached to me and exhorted me much and said that I had done a good service and told me to hold on to the faith that was taught me by Joseph. And more, he said on this subject that I cannot write." So Desdemona Fulmer had lived with Hiram for a while, and then moved out of there before Hiram agreed to the polygamy. And then William Clayton recorded in his journal that Desdemona came to his house on May 13, 1843, and inquired about staying with his family. It was just 13 days later that Clayton wrote in his journal that Hiram had accepted his brother's spiritual wife doctrine as coming from God. So while she was living at the homestead, she wrote, "Having been convinced of the truth of polygamy, I therefore entered into the order, but I dared not make it known even to my parents, or I was forbidden by the prophet, for it would endanger the life of Joseph and also many of the saints. Emma Smith tried on one occasion to poison me, but I dreamed a dream and told Joseph my dream, and he told me that she would do it if she had the opportunity, in consequence of which I requested Brother Joseph to find me a boarding place away from her where I could live in safety, which he did, and conveyed me in a buggy to that place." That was Hiram's house. "After a while, a year or so later, the news came to me that Joseph himself was poisoned in the mansion house. I asked him how he came to be poisoned. He said that Emma gave it to me in a tea." So that's the story. Desdemona Fulmer said that she left the homestead because she felt she was warned in a dream that Emma was going to poison her. Now, did she hear these stories and, you know, hear about poisoning? Where did she hear about poisoning from Joseph? And so she also left this.
So this is another this is another Emma Smith poison account, right?
Yeah, this is yes. But it's coming from one of Joseph's spiritual wives. So why would she think that Emma was capable of that? She says, in 1868, she said, "In the rise of polygamy, I was warned in a dream that Emmy Smith was going to poison me. And I told my dream to Brother Joseph, and he told me it was true. She would do it if she could." Well, you know, where is she getting the idea of poison? This is my point. If the other spiritual wives were talking about poisoning people, or she got wind of it somehow, maybe she had thought that Emma would do it to her. So, and then she has a dream about it. She talks to Joseph, and Joseph says, "Yeah, Emma would poison you." And obviously Joseph thought that Emma was capable of it because he told Brigham Young and others that Emma had done it to him. So this is just corroborating evidence that Joseph believed that Emma was capable of it. I don't believe that Emma was or did it, but Joseph thought so. And this is another angle. This shows that, yeah, there's something going on here with the poison, and people were scared about it at the time. So
what is your take on all of this? Are these credible? Should we pay attention to this? Was Joseph Smith issuing poisonings to get his enemies out of the way and vice versa?
I take Joseph's rhetoric very seriously. Here's a quote from Joseph Smith, and this is something to do with a man named Hiram Kimball and some others. Joseph called them dissenters. Here's what he said. "There is another person I will speak about. He is a Mormon, a certain man who lived here before we came here. The two first letters of his name are Hiram Kimball. When a man is baptized and becomes a member of the church, I have a right to talk about him and reprove him in public or private, whenever it is necessary or he deserves it. When the city passed an ordinance to collect wharfage from steamboats, he goes and tells the captains of the steamboats that he owned the landing and that they need not pay wharfage. I despise the man who will betray you with a kiss. I am determined to use up these men, and if they will not stop their operations, if this is not true, let him come forward and throw off the imputation. How are we to keep the peace in the city, defend ourselves against mobs, and keep innocent blood from being shed? By striking a blow at everything that rises up in disorder, I will wage an eternal warfare against with those that oppose me while I am laboring on behalf of this city. I will disgrace every man publishing him on the housetops who will not be still and mind his own business."
So what do you make of this, Dinger? You're a criminal prosecutor. Do these accounts sound legit to you?
Well, it's speculative, and it's not like we can run an autopsy now and test the compounds in people's systems. But I'm skeptical. So I just don't buy it. Number one, talking about the different poisonings, the fun one that everybody likes to talk about is Samuel Smith, right? Joseph Smith's brother. It's assumed he would have taken the mantle and run the church. And so everybody likes to talk about, was he poisoned? But if you really step back and look at it, it just doesn't fit for a lot of reasons. We know that he had to go get the bodies and that he drove in an open wagon both ways, and supposedly it rained. There was all sorts of sickness in Nauvoo, but the one fact that really sticks out to me is he died before most of the 12 apostles even got back to Nauvoo. And so Brigham Young didn't get back until August, and he died at the end of July. So it's fun to talk about. It's great to debate, but it just doesn't seem likely.
Do you think, though, that the men in Nauvoo were above that kind of stuff? If the kingdom of God is on the line, does that, I mean, in your work as a criminal prosecutor, do you see motives that are consistent with some of the political pressures that would have happened back then?
Absolutely. Motive, right? While it's not something that prosecutors have to prove, it's never an element of a crime. That's what juries and people care about. And there was motive there. And that's what's going to be really fun is, as we talk about this, is their motives, they don't see as bad. I mean, when you're protecting the kingdom of God, you're doing what God would want. And so that's what's so fascinating about this and what makes it so fun to talk about.
Okay, but don't forget, though, that Johnny's research on Nauvoo poisonings isn't the only nod to poison in Nauvoo. Remember that whole story that Joseph worried that Emma had poisoned him, or at least we think.
That's right. I mean, Joseph was so convinced that his wife had tried to kill him that his successor, Brigham Young, carried that myth with him to Utah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I love that quote. Can you read it for us? It's the one where Brigham Young gets up at General Conference and says, Emma is a liar and attempted to murder Joseph Smith. I love that quote.
I have it right here. General Conference was a lot more wild back in the day. Here it is. Quote, to my certain knowledge, Emma Smith is one of the damnedest liars I know of on this earth. Yet there is no good thing I would refuse to do for her, if she would only be a righteous woman. But she will continue in her wickedness. Not 6 months before the death of Joseph, he called his wife Emma into a secret council, and there he told her the truth, and called upon her to deny it if she could. He told her that the judgments of God would come upon her forthwith if she did not repent. He told her of the time she undertook to poison him, and he told her that she was a child of hell, and literally the most wicked woman on earth, that there was not one more wicked than she. He told her where she got the poison and how she put it in a cup of coffee. Said he, you got that poison from so-and-so, and I drank it, but you could not kill me. When it entered his stomach, he went to the door and threw it off. He spoke to her in that council in a very severe manner, and she never said one word in reply. I have witnesses of this scene all around who can testify that I am now telling the truth. Twice she undertook to kill him.
Okay, so let's just talk about that for a minute. Let's say that story is true, and we're going to talk about the problems with that story in a minute, but would that count as extra legal in your opinion? Does that fit our criteria? What is our criteria?
These ones are, I mean, it could be either way, right? I mean, we often think of passion killings when we're, you know, thinking of a spouse cheating or something like that, but poison is really thought out, right? It's not so much passion because you really have to put some thought into it. And so Emma's was kind of weird, kind of in between, right? Because in her mind, she was getting justice for herself. You have to remember that women in the frontier and women back then really didn't have a lot of options. She couldn't really turn to the courts, particularly in Nauvoo, where Joseph Smith ran the courts. And so it would just be incredibly difficult. So I think you could kind of argue this one either way. It's extra legal or maybe not.
We want to hear what you guys think out there. But let's hear what Richard Bushman writes of the poisoning accusation. He says, quote, through the late fall of winter of 1843 and 1844, Joseph and Emma's relationship broke down only once. During Sunday dinner on November 5th, Joseph became ill, rushed to the door, and vomited so violently that he dislocated his jaw. Yikes. Every symptom of poison, Richards notes in Joseph's diary. That night at the prayer meeting, Richards, and this would be Willard Richards, Richards notes in his diary that he wrote in code that Joseph and Emma did not dress in the usual special clothing, a sign that they were too much at odds to participate. The next day, Richards wrote that Joseph was, quote, busy with domestic concerns. Years later, in the anti-Emma atmosphere of Utah, Brigham Young spoke of a meeting where Joseph accused his wife of slipping poison into the coffee. Brigham interpreted Emma's refusal to answer as an admission of guilt. Though there probably was an argument, the poisoning accusation was unfounded. Joseph was susceptible to vomiting anyway. He had even dislocated his jaw while vomiting once before, and 5 weeks after the 1843 dinner episode, he was sick again, vomiting more violently than ever. During this last bout, Joseph said gratefully, "My wife waited on me." End quote.
I mean, you can argue that there was motive there. By the end of his life, Joseph and Emmett's marriage was really strained. She hated the practice of polygamy. She had found two letters in his pocket from one of his secret wives and Emma's closest friend, Eliza Arsenault.
Yeah, that's the famous story, right? And I actually asked Linda Newell, Emma Smith's biographer, about this. Since a Mormon history podcast, and she doesn't actually think there's a lot of evidence to back this up. But here's what she writes in her book. Okay, so this is a bit of a long quote. She says, "Joseph's relationship again showed its signs of intense stress, and they both suffered from ill health. In an 1866 conference address, Brigham Young told a story and goes on to recount it. But Linda says, quote, "The episode needs a larger context. Joseph's diary entry of the November 5th, 1843 describes becoming suddenly ill while eating dinner and vomiting so violently that he dislocated his jaw and raised fresh blood. He believed that he had been poisoned, but recovered enough to attend a prayer meeting in the hall over the store that evening. This was a meeting of the Quorum of the Anointed, those who had received their endowments, and most likely the secret council in which, according to Brigham Young, Joseph accused Emma of trying to poison him. Joseph's diary records that he and Emma did not dress for the prayer circle that night. Significantly, members did not customarily participate in the prayer circle if they had hard feelings against anyone else in the group." So this is, I think, what Bushman was talking about. "Joseph would subsequently experience periodic bouts of sudden nausea and vomiting. Many ailments could cause such symptoms, including acute indigestion, food poisoning, ulcer, gallstones, but only poisoning, bleeding, ulcers, or rarely food poisoning would have led to such an acute episode. Moreover, the 1844 poison strong enough to cause hemorrhaging in the stomach as rapidly after indigestion as Joseph's diary indicates, would not leave the victim well enough to attend a meeting just a few hours later. According to Joseph's diary, domestic concerns kept him busy the next morning." Perhaps, according to Linda Newell, Emma was able to convince her husband that she had not attempted to poison him. The previous evening, according to Brigham, Emma had cried when Joseph lashed out at her. Tears rather than an open defense are in keeping with at least one other occasion when she endured a public rebuke from Joseph. "When Joseph was suffering from violent vomiting the next month, he reported that Emma waited on me, assisted by my scribe Willard Richards and his brother Levi, who administered some herbs and mild drinks. I was never prostrated so low in such a short time before. By evening was considerably better." If Emma had convinced Joseph of her innocence in the earlier incident, Joseph apparently did not tell the others at the meeting, and Emma remained forever guilty in their minds. Arrowett Hale, who had heard the accusations later in Utah, wrote in her defense, quote, "A great many of the saints in these days think that the prophet wife Emma Hale Smith was a bad woman, that she tried to poison the prophet. There never was a more dutiful woman than Emma Smith to her husband till after the prophet had made public the revelation on celestial marriage. He began to take himself other wives. They proved a great trial to her. How many women in there in our day after 30 or 40 years that it does not try to the heart's bear? The prophet Joseph said that she was a good woman. Emma would and did go before the judges, rulers, and governors to plead for her husband. She would have laid her life down for him," end quote. So that's from Linda Newell. She thinks it's unfounded.
Yeah, but some historians believe to this day that Emma tried to poison him. They won't give it up. But it's more likely that Joseph was just sick, and he had plenty of other people worried tried to poison him. So in my point of view, I think it's nonsense. For her to attempt to kill him just seems absolutely absurd. She was a woman on the frontier with a lot of children, and the family was in significant debt. I mean, look what happened to her and her family when Smith did actually die. It nearly ruined them. So while we may think that there's motive here, it really wouldn't have benefited her or her children. And to do something like this, it would have taken some planning, and she was intelligent. She would have thought this through. She would have known that there would be no benefit to doing this. And then also, she's just a good person. She really is. The idea that murder, that she has the ability to murder someone, really is just a slander on her character. It's sexist, and it's anti-RLDS nonsense that we've been dealing with from the beginning of this church. You know, a lot of people, sadly, in this world are cheated on, but they don't murder their ex. But Brigham Young wanted to kind of castigate her and make her evil enough that she is. And so it's silly. It's just nonsense.
Okay, so we basically have just done an episode of really speculative stuff, right? Early poisonings of Nauvoo. So what we have said is we've given you a lot of stories, a lot of them that we don't believe. So why would we bring these up? Here's the thing. We may never know who tried to take justice into their own hands in Nauvoo. I, for one, believe people act like people no matter the setting. And we know that people who feel powerless often go to extreme measures. So could poisoning have been used? Absolutely. I think the very fact alone that Joseph or Brigham and people were worried about it shows that they knew it was a possibility. But, you know, we have plenty of other evidence to show that church members and leaders often took matters into their own hands. So whether Joseph Smith or his associates were in civic power or not, it doesn't really matter. There is a whole strain of history in Mormonism with extra legal justice.
Yeah, and so Mormons were incredibly inventive in all aspects of life. Whether you believe Mormonism is inspired or not, what you have to agree on is Mormonism is new, it's exciting, they pushed boundaries, they were inventive, and they did all this not just in religion, but in civics in the civil area as well. The saints had a persecution complex, and whether deserved or not, they truly believed that nobody else would help them, that there was no government that would, you know, stand up for their rights. And so they would have to exert their own God-given rights. And when they went west, they brought and created their own sense of justice, their own sense of the law. The civil government had already let them down time and time again, so it was time for them to execute justice as they saw fit, as they believed God saw fit. And to outsiders and Gentiles, this looked like extra legal justice. They did what they believed was just. Everyone else be damned.
And that's exactly what this podcast miniseries aims to do. We are going to explore extra legal cases in Mormonism and sometimes murder most foul.
On the next Sunstone Stories, Crime and Punishment, Extra Legal Justice on the Frontier. What do you do when someone steals your property and there's no one there to help solve the crime?
What if said property is your wife?
You'll have to wait until the next episode to see.
Sunstone depends on your generous support. Please sign up for a recurring donation at sunstone.org and support this and many other projects.